This is the World Retail Podcast, the premier platform for global retail leaders, where vision meets insight and innovation takes center stage. From AI to embedded finance, leadership to the ever-evolving consumer, we bring you the voices shaping the future of retail. World Retail Podcast, your front row seat to retail's next chapter.
Hello and welcome to the World Retail Podcast, brought to you by the World Retail Congress. My name is Ian McGarrigle and I am the founder and chair of the World Retail Congress. This episode is part of a special series called Retail Leadership Voices, which I'm delighted to be co-hosting with the global team from the executive search firm Spencer Stuart Associates. This series will bring you high-level interviews with some top retail leaders to learn more about their career journey, their perspective on what it means to be a leader in retailing today, their thoughts on the industry, and above all, we will try and find out more about them on a personal level. Today's interview was with Alexis Nizard, the CEO of Swarovski, one of the world's leading jewelers and brands. Alexis has an impressive track record of leading global businesses and brands, so his insights into leadership and transformation were fascinating. I was joined for this special interview by Georgie Conda, Spencer Stuart's Global Head of Fashion and Luxury, based in Milan. I very much hope you enjoy this episode with Georgie and I in conversation with Alexis Nizard. Hello, Georgie, and thank you for joining me for this special episode of the Retail Leadership Voices series for the World Retail Podcast. How are you?
Well, I'm great, and thank you for having me.
So, Georgie, before we introduce Alexis, with your vast experience of the luxury and fashion sectors anyway, I wonder maybe you could start us off with giving some context, your thoughts on where the luxury sector is at the moment, and particularly, obviously, where Swarovski fits into that and the challenges, if I can describe it as that, that you would see Alexis has in the business and the sector.
Well, that's a great question, Ian. So I think it's widely known that luxury isn't performing fabulously as a sector, and it hasn't for the past sort of 18, 24 months. And, you know, we could probably talk for hours for all the reasons and what's leading to this. But suffice it to say that the sector will have to face some significant leadership challenges, which our hypothesis is will bring about significant changes and also leadership and who the people will be that will be navigating the luxury brands out of this difficult situation, but also their approaches. And I think Swarovski is a fantastic example. Swarovski is a historical brand, 127 years old, a family-run business for over a century. And Alexis here is the first CEO, actually, who is not from the family. Alexis comes from broad CEO and other and leadership experiences from consumer brands, celebrated and great consumer brands, and brings definitely a different approach and a different culture to this sector. Alexis will talk much more about it, and we'll wait for him to give us this his point of view.
Well, thanks for that, Georgie. That sets it up really nicely. It's going to be a great conversation. So I think without further ado, it's my great pleasure to welcome and introduce Alexis to the World Retail Podcast. Hi, Alexis. Good to meet you.
Hi, Ian. A pleasure. Thank you.
So, Georgie, over to you. I think we've got plenty of really interesting topics to discuss with Alexis.
Absolutely. So I would have the first question that I would like to ask you, Alexis, is, as we mentioned before, in July 2022, you became the first person outside the Swarovski family to lead the brand in its 127-year-old history. So that's quite a responsibility. Can you talk us through how your appointment came about?
Yeah, as you might know, after the pandemic, the company was in a very difficult situation. That was the result, of course, of the pandemic, but also from some excesses in the previous strategy that cost the company quite a bit of scale and a significant chunk of consumers. So at that point in time, there was a decision among shareholders to professionalize the governance of the company by appointing a board of directors, which was majority independent and chaired by an independent director with family representation, but not a majority representation. And in turn, that board decided that they needed to appoint a professional CEO from the outside to run the company and complete the professionalization of the governance and the leadership of the company. My mandate was three very simple. One is to turn around the company. Two is to reposition the brand in the luxury space. All that whilst respecting the heritage and the legacy of the company and its founders.
Building on that, Alexis, as an outsider to the Swarovski family and that mandate and remit that you got, which is quite wide ranging, how do you manage the relationships with the key stakeholders across the business?
Any CEO has to spend about one third of their time in stakeholder management. And whether you're a CEO of a publicly traded company, whether you're a CEO of a private equity held company, or you're CEO of a family owned company. So one third of your time is part of the job. That's why I say to people, you know, like it, you don't like it, that's the job. It's not for everyone, but that's it. For me, stakeholder management includes shareholders, includes the board, includes employees, includes the communities in which we operate, it includes customers, and includes suppliers. All of these are stakeholders for which I have a duty to maintain bridges and an ongoing communication stream. And amongst those are, of course, our shareholders, which happen to be family members. And through information and through mutual trust building, I try my best to have a fruitful and mutually productive relationship. Interestingly, in that context, one needs to bear in mind that, at least in my view, one third is about right. Some people think you have to spend a lot more time on that, but I have to remind everyone that a CEO is supposed to be running a company, not to be a full-time politician. And if you're doing more than 50% of your time on that, you're actually not doing your job. In the context also of a family relationship, three things are important to bear in mind, because I see in the external world, there is always a tendency to think that family businesses are like some kind of monolithic type of governance, whereas that's hardly ever the case. There's one thing between working for a family business where you have an entrepreneur from Bologna with his daughter, and another thing, which is to have almost 150 shareholders, which is the case with us, which is, you can almost look at it as a mini publicly traded company. What is important, I think, and my advice would be for any CEO who takes over a family business, is not only to understand what kind of company, what kind of legacy, what kind of family you're dealing with, but also to make you understood, you and they understand what kind of leader you are. Because it takes two to tango. It's not a one-way street. And sometimes, you know, families are very sincere about having a fully empowered CEO that runs the company like a CEO should. Some might not be. Some might be intellectually, but not yet emotionally. And in fact, many of them are looking for a COO or chargé d'affaires. And that is why it's important to have that clarity up front, including also what does the role exactly entail. I'm very conscious that I am running a company that is family-owned, and I do it with serenity, conviction. But I am not running a family office, which is a very different thing. So this kind of clarity, I think, when you start a relationship, is important to put it on the table. And once that is done, I think the basis for a mutually respectful, fruitful, and productive relationship will be laid.
Thank you, Alexis. Let me ask you another question about your experience, at Swarovski. So 3 years on from your appointment, what are your reflections on how it has gone? So, for instance, what has been the biggest surprise?
Yeah, it's a fun question to ask. I always ask it also to other people. The two surprises for me, I've done a lot of homework. I don't accept appointments casually. So So hopefully I was not overly surprised by things, because otherwise I wouldn't have done my job correctly. So two things that surprised me. One was culture, and two was the brand. The culture surprised me positively and less positively, to be frank. It is on the positive side, it's a culture that has a lot of taste. Swarovski people do beautiful things. The offices are beautiful. People have a sense of style. The products are beautiful. The retail experience is beautiful. The conferences are beautiful. And it's not just there is like a central team of highly competent people who have taste, who runs everything. No, it is very well ingrained in the organization. And for a business like ours, which is what I call an uber discretionary business, that's important because we don't sell necessities. So that is one of the positive surprises I had. The other one is agility. It's a company that moves fast, incredibly fast. I've worked for some bigger conglomerates, which I will not name, where, I mean, the speed of Swarovski is like 10 to 20 times. From the first time we came up with a new store concept this year, to the moment we were executed the first was 8 weeks. Within 8 weeks, blueprint, rental, equipment, execution, staff, training, systems, IT. I mean, it's a very, very agile and quick company, which is very remarkable, and which is allowing us to navigate properly in a current environment, which is extremely turbulent, as you well know. And then the last positive thing is a sense of intellectual humility. When people talk about humility and confidence, I know a few years ago there was the fashion that the humbler you are, the better. And for me, I distinguish very clearly between attitudinal humility and intellectual humility. Attitudinal humility, I'm not too bothered about. I mean, everybody has their style that works for them. I think we have to be tolerant and diverse in that sense. But for me, intellectual humility is important. Everybody needs to be a student. Everybody needs to learn from everybody's successes and failure, otherwise you don't evolve. And Swarovski has a lot of intellectual humility, which I greatly respect. The one thing that surprised me less positively when I joined was at that time, there wasn't a real sense of P&L responsibility among senior leadership. Ultimately, there was a sense that, the P&L is ultimately the CEO's and the board's and shareholders' responsibility, which obviously is not correct. So we spent quite a lot of time to evolve that way of thinking and that aspect of the culture, which I'm pleased to say has, to a large extent, been fixed by now. And today, I'm proud to say that most of my senior leadership is extremely P&L oriented, which is really important because we do beautiful things, but I remind them that we're running a business, not a museum. And that's a very different thing. The other thing that surprised me positively is the power of the brand. It's a very, very rich brand. It has texture, it has personality, it has glitz, it has history. You can like it, you cannot like it, but you can't confuse it with another one. And that's something which is extremely powerful when you run a brand, because ultimately, CEO, all you like, but what am I? I'm a brand man. I'm a brand man. Ultimately, if I don't know how to run the brand, I don't have anything in the final end. And that is an asset that is superbly powerful.
If I can just jump in at this, I love that point. And as you are a brand man, what was your due diligence on looking at the brand before you decided to join Swarovski?
What was interesting is I looked a lot at it as a consumer. I looked at it as a professional, and I studied the way people talked about it, whether it is consumers or professionals, also executives from the company, how they talked about the brand. So, and I started triangulating where are the areas that you need absolutely to preserve, and which are the areas that could be nurtured so vigorously. I mean, the whole joy part, the joyful part of the brand, we're dialing it up a lot because that is profoundly in the DNA and, in my view, could be exploited a lot more down the road. Because in the end, I mean, I have discussion with Georgie a few times on this. What does luxury do? Ultimately, it gives you joy and it gives you a sense of self-worth. That's it. You think because you're worth it? you're buying yourself that piece or that luggage or that watch. And it gives you joy when you do that. That's it. That's what it does.
Absolutely true. So let me ask you a little bit about your former experience. So you've had an incredibly varied leadership career, including two CEO roles, one with Bata, one with Kantar. You've held senior positions with Heineken, Procter & Gamble for many years. So which of these experiences do you think best prepared you for the role that you hold today at Swarovski?
Inevitably, they all did. They all did, each one in a way. P&G is a corporate boot camp. When you leave P&G after several years, you are extremely well-honed professional in every aspect. P&L management, communication, governance, on every aspect. It's an incredibly rich and rigorous school. And I'm very grateful for that development I had. I spent 17 years there. At Heineken, a very different culture. It's a fun company with a fun atmosphere in a fun category that is located in a fun city. So that was a lot of fun, I have to say. But what I've learned from Heineken, because in Heineken, in the end, I had a dual role. I was Global Chief Marketing and Innovation Officer, as well as the President of the Europe region, which is the largest region for Heineken. What I've learned over there is how to create a proper governance of a global brand. Because when I joined Heineken, Heineken was not a global brand. It was a global trademark. And that is a very different thing. A global trademark is that you use the logo and the name and you do with it whatever you want. Under my administration, they didn't do with it whatever they wanted. It needed to be run. It was not very popular with everyone, I tell you, but it was very, very beneficial for the company and for the business. And as a president of Europe, a region which was stagnating for more than 10 years in terms of growth, I learned the art of elaborate revenue management. And we really spend a lot of time thinking in terms of profit sales, in terms of revenue management through all the pillars when it gets to beyond volume and pricing. How do you maximize channel opportunities, channel mixes, sizing, serving? We went through modeling that was quite elaborate. And I still have all these models with me. They're mine, by the way, so I'm not stealing anybody's intellectual property. But on revenue management, that was quite an experience. We actually put it back to growth within less than 1 year. Last but not, Kantar was a little short, so I don't have a heck of a lot to say. But the one thing is clear is that having help from external sources is good. Having too much help from external sources is less good, because then in the end, you lose the intellectual narrative of a company. And then McKinsey, I think, you know, breadth of experiences across industries, each one with their own dynamic idiosyncrasies, allows you to actually cross-fertilize learnings from different industries, which I find quite enriching.
Given your international, your global experience, it's unsurprising what you've been doing at Swarovski under your leadership is to begin expanding internationally in some key cities, New York, Paris, Milan, Shanghai, with major flagships. So can you talk about your plans and your strategies there, and kind of what does that physical customer experience look and feel like in the luxury space for you at, under the Swarovski brand?
The store is extremely important, and the store will never die. You know, a few years ago, you're having the usual pundits telling you it's the death of brick and mortar and all kind of stuff like that, which is nonsense. Like when digital communication started in marketing, telling you it's the death of the TV set. Well, the TV set will never die either. So the store is incredibly important. And for us in particular, flagships are very important because they play the following roles. First, they are a cultural institution. You're bringing a brand's culture to a city, and you're bringing the cultural fabric of the city to your store. So they become a cultural statement in many aspects. And as we all know, in luxury, cultural associations are really important because people need to feel that they belong to something which is bigger than themselves. Second is it's a brand temple. This is our place. This is where we show everything what we are about. It's a place to transact. But most importantly, and that's what people forget sometimes, it has to be fun. There are flagships where you have a blast. You walk, you're curious, you interact, you discover. And there are flagships which are dreadful. They are so predictable and so boring. You go floor one, floor two, floor three, floor four. I mean, they're really dreadful. I'm not going to name them, but I'm sure you can think about a few like that. So for us, it has to be a space that is fun, that is surprising. Because a brand has to be consistent, but it should never be predictable. Because predictability is a kiss of death for a brand.
So looking at the luxury sector sort of more broadly, what do you think makes it different to other consumer sectors that you've worked in? And how has that changed your approach to running the brand and also your leadership style?
The one most important thing in luxury versus the rest is we have to understand that for the most part, it is discretionary. It's discretionary. Nobody needs it. And everybody can find a cheaper alternative very quickly or no alternative at all. I mean, I have 12 watches. I could very well live with one. Second is, once somebody wants to participate in that space, it becomes a desirability game. How do you make the brand desirable? And how do you build that desirability in a very systematic? Because we do it very systematically and diligently through in a very clear framework that is proprietary to Swarovski. So these are things which are important and to recognize upfront. Second is that it has to be beautiful everywhere. When you're a luxury brand, you can't afford to have a blind eye on something. That the gift wrap is ugly or doesn't work or doesn't close or the quality is not there or the window is not clean. You can't do that. You have to be obsessed with execution, obsessed until the end. This is where the fact that Swarovski people have passion for the brand and have a very high level of taste is a competitive advantage for us. And last but not least is the human touch. When you go, in the end, do you feel valued or not? If we're saying that a sense of self-worth is important, being treated poorly doesn't really exactly go with that. So that is why, for me, as a luxury consumer, all these people who put on an attitude when you go to their stores or make you feel they're doing you a favor by giving you a product, that's not for me. If I'm paying a lot of money, I want it to be recognized. And increasingly, many consumers in the luxury space also think and feel that way. So these are, for me, elements which are different in the luxury industry versus the rest. What is also different, which is interesting, I've never seen an industry that recycles so much talent. It's been stunning where you see the same people circling and circling and circling. I think it's a weakness, in fact. There is less original thinking. There is a lot of conventional thinking, which I think is a missed opportunity for the industry. You know my famous joke, Georgie, with the Italian black turtlenecks that keep circulating. So I think diversity of thinking could be an opportunity for this space. That's a side comment that I make. But I would say discretionary, desirability, beauty, and the human touch are what characterizes that industry. I did not change my leadership approach by working in luxury. For me, what requires an adaptation of a leadership approach is not so much the industry you're in as the governance you're working with, the stage of development of the company you're leading, and organizational maturity. This is where you have to adapt. And obviously, even if you're working within the same industry, you go to a company that is pre-IPO, a company that is in cruising altitude, a company that is in turnaround mood, you obviously have to lead differently. If you're having an organization which has a high degree of competence and maturity, or an organization that is not really the case, then you lead very differently. In the latter case, you have to be more directive. In the former case, you have to be more what I call tight, loose, tight, which is one of my leadership mantras, as you know.
Yeah.
But Alexis, building on that, as a retail leader or a leader in the retail industry, I have so many conversations with retail leaders over the last 2-3 years that say they've never known a time more challenging than this, that you can't predict, can't forecast the next big, you know, existential crisis or problem. And of course, that makes it really hard to navigate through that, you know, when you've got a day job, where you've got a big transformation strategy. How do you navigate through and stay focused on, you know, what you need to do short, medium, long term with, as I say, so many challenges that, you know, just apparently just keep coming at us every year, or multiple challenges every year?
Both of you are senior enough to know what a light bulb is. The art for me of navigating a transformation in a turbulent environment is knowing how to balance your focus between your navel and the light bulb. And what do I mean by that? If you're extremely externally focused and following every trend, you end up doing what I call mosquito management, which is the mosquito just running to the next source of light from here to here to here. And now it's end-to-end and supply chain. Now it is AI. Now it is this. Now it is that. And you go crazy. And you actually become inefficient, ineffective, unfocused. If you look too much at your own navel, you're not privy to the key developments happening in the marketplace, to the competitive landscape, to the cultural mood of the customer, and all the rest of it. So having a good balance between these two, for me, is important and is a matter of a judgment call from leaders. For us, once we've decided to go on pop luxury, we're just executing it all out. We're not sitting every day and looking up the window and trying to change it or evolve it unnecessarily. That's one. So staying the course, looking at the light bulb every once in a while, but not all the time, and staying the course and executing with discipline. Second, what we're trying to do, we try to avoid the obvious mistakes that some of the majors in luxury have made. You can name a few, but, you know, we're trying to make sure that creativity is creative and original. You know, you've seen in the space many people just hiding behind logos, and at some point this has a limited runway. We haven't been greedy with pricing. We actually took pricing just in line with inflation. We didn't overdo it. And I think ultimately customers appreciate that. We also, basically, just to say, we avoided the obvious mistakes in the process. You know, it'll be pretentious of me to say that we've navigated it successfully. It's a long path. It's a long runway. The crisis is not over, and you have to win every day to be a winner. You can't win part of the journey and not the other part. And that's what we're focused on today. Will we make mistakes? Probably. But the art will be to get back on our horses quickly. And this is where the agility of the company is important.
So let me ask you a similar but yet different question, you know, building on what you just told us. So Swarovski is clearly a hugely established brand, right, with a very long heritage. So how do you continue to appeal to future generations? So how do you develop a future-proof strategy for a brand like that?
Yeah. It's a very good question, and it's a lot of what you know keeps me thinking. Obviously, the mere structure of our pop luxury positioning is already very helpful for that, very auspicious, because part of the pop positioning is being always in the zeitgeist, being always unapologetically modern. That is a fundamental part of the way we built the brand. So we are in tune with cultural trends. So that is part of the way we manage the brand. Now, when it gets to bridging towards younger generations, first you have to recruit them. And we have all a wide array of tools to recruit younger consumers. Some of them are more mechanical tools like CRM. Some of them are more subliminal tools like, identifying brand ambassadors that appeal to a younger generation. And then how to bond with them on a going basis. And we do that systematically. So far, it's been successful. Actually, Gen Z and millennials are now almost half of our customer base. And our recruiting efforts are stronger and stronger every quarter. So far, we've been managing, I would say, reasonably well. But the zeitgeist, whilst maintaining heritage, not instead of, is makes a huge difference. Because throwing the baby out with the bathwater is not the solution.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we have to ask you, obviously, a question about AI.
Of course, you do.
Of course. So we cannot not ask it, right? So,
And I cannot not answer it.
exactly. So very, very, what is your point of view about AI, and how do you think it can help Swarovski?
I'm not going to tell you anything original. AI can be a formidable tool to drive efficiency and productivity. We use it already in very different aspects. We're already using it in product design. We're using it in creative communication. We use it in the S&OP process. We use it in our supply chain. We're using it. Am I using it much more than anybody else? I don't know. But we're definitely trying to use it as much as we can. However, what is really important is that AI is subordinate to the company strategy. It's not the other way around. Because oftentimes when people get infatuated with technologies, then they end up wanting to subordinate their business strategy to the technology. That's not how the world should work. So this is why we're being very diligent when we review our AI strategy. That's the company strategy. Where can AI be an enabler? Not this is what AI can do, what can you do with it? Which is a very different approach.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you. I've heard this from you before, so
I'm very
and
consistent. You will see it. I'm
I
dreadfully consistent.
no, I just wanted to make sure it comes out also in this interview. So at Spencer Stuart, we clearly, given what we do, we firmly believe that it's people and talent that power an organization. And the CEO sets the tone, and the business follows that tone, right? So what type of culture have you introduced at Swarovski, and how do you maintain and reinforce it over time?
One, there are a lot of misconceptions in my experience about culture. We always presume that all companies have cultures and that these cultures are as clear-cut and shared across companies. That's not necessarily the case. You have companies that have very strong culture, which are mostly companies that promote from within. I mean, you take a McKinsey, you take a Procter and Gamble, they have very strong cultures for obvious reasons. It's the same people evolving this culture together for decades. When you have a company where most people have been tenured for a year and a half, you're going to have a more diluted culture. And except if you're having a personality cult type of company where the culture of the company becomes a replica of the personality of the founder, or of the creative director, or of Giorgio Armani, or God knows what. But for all other cases, you have various degrees of what I call cultural density in a company. And one has to recognize that. There's always something. How dense it is depends. And I hold the view that not a CEO cannot and should not change a company's culture, should evolve it. Because it will be pretentious to think that under an administration ranging anywhere between 3 to 6 to 7 years, a company that's been around a century or more is going to change its culture. It's presumptuous. And even if that were to succeed, it could be more damaging than otherwise. So that is why I take it with a grain of humility to say my role is to evolve it for what is necessary for the company to perform in the long term. And these elements of the culture I described earlier, for me, taste, passion for the brand, agility, they're very precious, and I'm nurturing them. The part of lack of P&L maturity is not acceptable, and you cannot be a company built to last with that kind of deficit. So that is why my process was basically mostly to instill a results orientation and a winning spirit. You can be beautiful. You can look have beautiful product, beautiful stores. It's not, you're not winning in the market. You're just running a museum. And nobody's interested in running a museum. Even creative directors, right, that want to be recognized and be written about and talked about. In the end, if their stuff doesn't sell, they don't go very far. So winning in the market is essentially important for everybody. And that, to me, has been a very, very important element of my cultural evolution, which, of course, comes with operating discipline, because results don't just happen. You have to deliver them. And a personal leadership trait, which is for me my mantra, which is tight, loose, tight. Tight on values, tight on strategy, tight on objectives, tight on results. In the middle, you're hiring capable people, let them run it. Not just go dictate and micromanage them. So that is my mantra as a leader.
Thank you. That's super interesting, Alexis. And so we typically like to sort of close these interviews with a quick fire quiz, right? So quick questions, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. We do, for certainly. So let me shoot the first question. So what is one subject that you would really like to learn more about today?
Luck.
Elaborate.
Luck to me is one of the biggest fascinations in life. You know, modern post-industrial culture wants to educate everybody that you make your own luck, and luck is preparation, opportunity. You've read all that. But yeah, in the end, take only where you're born, when you're born, and from whom you're born already determines 90% of your life. And I can even argue with the remaining 10% in terms of education, all the rest of it. Now, how do you reconcile that with a highly purposeful, ambitious, and game-changing mentality is something that I find interesting. So I find luck a big fascinating topic.
So that's the first time I hear that. So it gets us thinking too.
Yeah. But by the way, it's a very disturbing topic. Most people resist it. They don't. Yeah. Most people don't like to recognize that luck is important, because people feel less in control. People want to believe that it's what I do that makes what I am. You know, like, for example, I have a friend of mine who's super healthy and, you know, exercises, doesn't drink a lot, you know, all this stuff. And then, you know, my partner said, you see, he's in great shape. He's old because of what he does. I said, yeah, and his brother is 99 years old and he hasn't done any of that. So I can argue maybe it's his genes.
So in a sort of similar way, building on that, Alexis, what gives you confidence?
Knowledge. Yep. Knowledge. I'm a very curious person. Mm-hmm. I'm a very avid reader. I read a book almost every week. And when I know my stuff, it gives me confidence. I don't think it's particular to me. I think that should be the case with most people in the end. But knowledge is important. And unfortunately, with what's happening now with modern politics and social media, knowledge is getting diluted. There is deliberate attempts at creating doubt on what is an absolute objective truth and what is not. And that is one of the issues we have to deal with in the future generations, particularly with our kids, the deficit in trust in society. Because we can't have a civilized society if there isn't a more important trust capital.
Yeah. And actually, just there, a link to that, is there any interesting recent read you would like to recommend?
Yeah, I just finished an interesting one, which is called 12 History of the World in 12 Shipwrecks. So here you have an archaeologist, historian, who goes and dives in shipwrecks And when he goes there, he describes to you what he sees. Then he extrapolates that to the world, to describing the world and the context in which that shipwreck happened. So, for example, you have a shipwreck in the time of Ramses II. He will tell you what was going on in China at that time. What was that ship transporting? Who was actually the ruler in Egypt? What was happening in Egypt at that time? And then you have it up until World War II. I love history. So it's, I know that's not the case for everyone, but I find it very, very, very entertaining.
That sounds fascinating. What's a great lesson that a mentor or a former boss has taught you?
Never overpromise. It's old-fashioned, it's unoriginal, but it's true. If you overpromise, you'll be a hero for a day. And that's it. So that is why it's really important for me having dependable forecasts. That doesn't prevent you from being ambitious, from trying to do a lot, but you can't promise people who depend on you, upward, downward, and sideways, something that is unlikely to happen. It is irresponsible.
Maybe another one from me. You've worked in many countries, you speak many languages. What would you say to travelers or people looking where to go to next? Which is the one city you would really recommend?
Samarkand.
Yeah.
Samarkand in Uzbekistan. Mm-hmm. It is very rich in history, and it's probably some of the most beautiful Islamic art I've ever seen. Highly recommended.
Thank you.
It can be very hot in summer. Just be careful.
Just shifting topic a little bit, and I think you've talked about this a little bit, but already throughout the conversation. But what are the qualities that you most value in people?
In general or in business?
In business, I would say.
In business, one is reliability. Mm-hmm. I value it to a great degree. People who know what they're talking about, people who are accurate, people who do what they say and say what they do. For me, that's a very, very important thing. And the fact that you are creative or think outside the box should not come at the detriment of that. Both are possible. Second thing is curiosity. I'm a CEO, so I can't be an expert in everything. Of course, I have a major in brand and in retail, but I'm not a subject matter expert. And I expect people who are subject matter expert to know their subjects better than I do. So that means curiosity, which means self-development. And I respect that a great deal in people.
So changing topics again a little bit, when you're not working, how do you spend your time?
Yeah, I'm going to disappoint you here, because every time you ask that for someone in my generation, they're going to answer you with sports. So I do some, but I'm not exactly fanatic. I love wine pairing. I love exotic traveling. I've been to places you cannot imagine. and I love reading. I'm passionate about history and about opera.
Wow. So next time you're in Milan, please let me know, because obviously we'll have to go to see something at the Scala together.
With great pleasure. I just went to Verona this year. Last year we went to Salzburg. But hey, if you're game in Milan, I'm in.
Yeah, absolutely. I love opera as well. Probably not as much as you do, but it's something that I enjoy a lot. So please.
It's one of the most complete art forms. It's, if you think about it, it's one of the most complete art forms. You have music, you have vocals, you have theater, you have styling, you have even architecture.
Yeah,
you have everything. It's a very complete art form. I love it.
So Alexis, our last question and the last question for this episode of the podcast, what's exciting you the most about the next 12 months in retailing?
For us, we're having a very rich program coming for Swarovski. Mm-hmm. We're planning with more and more early horizons, and one of the coolest event that's going to happen is our major brand moment, Masters of Light in Hollywood. That's going to take place in October. It's basically Swarovski going to Hollywood, and it's going to be a major exhibition showcasing all our collaborations with stylists, costume designers, and celebrities like Greta Garbo and you name it over history, and projecting this into the future and the current times and the zeitgeist. It's going to be a really cool event, and I really look forward to it. Other than that, we're launching the Vienna collection. We're having major activation events in major cities in Europe before the end of the year. And we're continuing with Ariana Grande early 2026. So from a Swarovski standpoint, there is a lot of exciting developments happening. And we're continuing expansion in the US, successful expansion in the US. In the retail industry in general, I always learn from my colleagues in other parts of the industry. One of the most areas that I'm mostly curious about is how will the big box department stores in the US fare? I've seen the news from Macy's, which was quite heartening, because by the way, Macy's is a customer of Swarovski, and the fact of whether most of these will actually manage to turn their performance around and to be more sustainable going forward, because that is a big barometer of the retail industry.
Alexis, thank you so much. This has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. I've learned so much, and you've got a huge amount of work that you're tackling at Swarovski, but with clearly very positive effects. And thank you for sharing your perspective on leadership within the retail industry. And Georgia, I don't know if you've got any sort of final comment, but for me, it's been a great episode.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alexis, for doing this with us. And well, let's hope all the best for the next 12 months, I guess, with all
Thank
of
you,
this
Georgie.
fun.
Thank you, Georgie. And sorry to have bored you with things you have already heard before, probably.
No, it's always great. And there's always something new with you. So it was great.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. No,
thank you,
thank you. Thank you,
Georgie.
Alexis. Thank you, Georgie. It's been a great episode.
Thank
Thank you very much.
Sonia.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the World Retail Podcast, part of our special series called Retail Leadership Voices, brought to you in partnership with the global team from the executive search firm Spencer Stuart Associates. We hope today's conversation gave you valuable insights into retail leadership through the experience of a proven leader. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and don't forget to leave us a review. It really helps others find the show. To stay up to date with the latest from the World Retail Congress and to access more exclusive content, visit us at www.worldretailcongress.com and follow us on LinkedIn. We'll be back soon with more thought-provoking discussions from the front lines of retail. Until then, thanks for listening.